Why do the righteous suffer? What answer do we have for the suffering we see and experience? Why does God allow it? These are some of the questions that trouble us, and there's not a full answer to them in the scripture. We probably could not understand, even if the full answer were given. But some reasons are given to us to go by, and the comforting fact that for all our sufferings, God has ample compensation awaiting us. And so it turns out in Job's case. In the introduction, verses 1 through 5, we read about the person and character of Job. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. And his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about, when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Here's the introduction to the drama. In fact, chapters 1 and 2 are historical. First of all, when was Job written? Many questions, you know, there are many people who give different answers to that question. I would say it was written around the time of the patriarchs, Abraham or even those before him. And the reason why we can say that is from the internal evidence of the book. For example, Job lived for quite a long life. Here we read about people who live quite long lives. At the end of the book of Job, we read that he, even after his trial, he lived 140 years. That was true before Moses. But after the days of Moses, you don't come across such long lives. Also, a second evidence that you can tell that this book of Job was, that Job lived a long time ago, is that the knowledge of God was widespread comparatively widespread in the world. It wasn't so after Moses. It was quite restricted. It was finally found only amongst the people of Israel and a few scattered non-Jews, non-Hebrews. But in the time of Job, from the way he and his friends talk, there was quite a widespread knowledge of God. And that would make it somewhere just after the flood, before the world sank into idolatry. A third evidence that we can tell that Job lived in the days of the patriarchs. Sorry, the question was wrong at the beginning. When was Job written? When did Job live? That should be the question. A third evidence is that sacrifices were still being offered by the heads of houses. When Moses was raised up to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt, priesthood was now, and sacrifice was now restricted to one of the 12 tribes, the Levites. But in Job's case, we find he did what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did, and Noah. They offered sacrifices as the heads and as the priests of their family. And these sacrifices were not offered at a central sanctuary, such as the temple. They were offered in local centers where they lived. So there again it shows an early date for the life of Job. There is no mention, here's another clue, there's no mention of the Exodus, there's no mention of the Hebrews, no mention of Abraham. So it must be before them, even perhaps before Abraham. Who wrote the book of Job? Most probably Moses. He fled from Egypt at the age of 40, and for 40 years he lived in the land of Midian, which is in the territory of the land of Uz. And this story was probably reduced by him in writing. That's what tradition tells us. And you also find in the book of Job a few Arabic words. So you can see that it had some contribution from Arab culture and from the Arabs, early Arab civilization. Well, there are some of the clues that you and I can use as to the time of Job and the time it was written. Now let's look at the story. The introduction to the drama is in chapter 1. Here is a man that's living in the land of Uz. When we want to find out where the land of Uz is, we can find two passages. One is in Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah chapter 25. Jeremiah 25 and verse 17 through 20. Then I took the cup from the Lord's hand and made all the nations drink to whom the Lord sent me, Jerusalem and the cities of Judah and its kings and its princes, to make them a ruin, a horror, a hissing, and a curse, as it is this day. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, his servants, his princes, and all his people, and all the foreign people, all the kings of the land of Uz, all the kings of the land of the Philistines, even Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and the remnant of Ashdod, etc. The general area is the Middle East, including what is now Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And that's why we say that it must be, at least in these verses, that's the area where Uz is to be found, somewhere between Egypt and Canaan. There's another verse in the book of Lamentations which follows Jeremiah, the prophecy of Jeremiah. In Lamentations chapter 4, verse 21. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who dwells in the land of Uz. But the cup will come around to you as well. You will become drunk and make yourself naked. That's Lamentations, chapter 4 and verse 21. Edom, the Edomites, dwelt in the southeast. You know where the Dead Sea is. It's just to the southeast of that, in what is now called the Arabian Peninsula. That's where the Edomites lived, and that's also called the land of Uz. So there we are, we get a general idea of where the territory was. In the land that was later occupied by the Midianites, and now it is partly Jordan, partly Saudi Arabia. We're told about Job that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. He was not a Hebrew. He was one of those people that lived long before the Hebrews became a nation. And here's a God-fearing man who knew God and who sought to serve God. We find his family. He has 7 sons and 3 daughters. We see his possessions in verse 3. And then we read also about his sons, that they used to have what we would call birthday parties. That's really what it was. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. They used to celebrate their birthdays the way you and I would today, and they would have a party. So they sent for their three sisters to join them to eat and drink with them. But Job wasn't happy about this. At least, it was okay for them to have their celebration. But he knew very well that in their youthful exuberance, they may well have done something that displeased God. Maybe they did something which I find myself uncomfortable with. Telling jokes about God. Or telling jokes with God in them. I think that's terribly wrong. I feel that's very dangerous. And it might be that this is what happened. That in the joke they more or less lowered God. Lowered God's standard of holiness. Or cast a slight upon God. Who knows what it was. But just to be on the safe side, after their birthday party was over, he'd haul them over and have a prayer meeting. He would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Just to make sure that if they had displeased God or angered God, that those sacrifices would cover their sins. But in this example, you and I also have an object lesson. If and when we become parents, we should do what Job does. Rise up early every morning and offer sacrifice for our children. We don't offer literal sacrifices, but certainly we should pray daily for our children. We should take this as our model, as parents or as future parents, that this is what we're going to do. We're going to pray for our children daily. It's a very good habit to have. Now, while this was happening on earth, there was a drama happening in heaven. And we read about it in the following verses. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." What Satan was really saying is, "That's all my dominion. It's all under my control. I have free rein. I can go where I like. Everybody's under my thumb." Really, that was what he was saying to God. "I roam unchallenged on the earth, on the earth." And then God, the Lord, spoke to Satan in verse 8. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Here was a man that was an outstanding challenge and exception to the rule of Satan. No one that could compare. But Satan shot back his reply. He says, "Oh, it's not piety in Job. It's not piety in Job. It's policy." This is how he puts it, verse 9 and 10. Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land." So Job is really just quite mercenary. He may appear to be very pious, but it's only because he knows that he gets something out of it. And so he says in verse 11, "But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse thee to thy face." The Lord accepted the challenge. It's not as though the Lord didn't know, but the Lord agreed to demonstrate that Satan was a liar and that Job was far more, was Job's love for God went far deeper than the desire really to stay on the right side of God. So the Lord, verse 12, then the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. All right, said the Lord, you can do what you like with all that Job has. You think that he serves me for what I've given him. You're welcome to do what you like with what I've given him. And then we will see if he curses me to my face. Satan lost no time bringing evil on Job. Verse 13. Now it happened on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Those three bands that the Chaldeans made out were probably for effective capture of any fugitives, and also to make sure that nobody got away. Complete destruction. Gideon used that strategy later on. He formed three bands to surround the Midianites. Verse 18, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died. And I alone have escaped to tell you. In that part of the world, there were those great sandstorms and windstorms that came from the east, because that's where the desert was. And it was one of these violent windstorms, much more ferocious than anything they had ever known, that finally blew down the house, knocked down the house on the young people and buried them in its ruins. What was Job's response? He didn't curse God. Verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head. And he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. What he meant was, I brought nothing into this world. I'm going back to my original source, to the source from which I and my mother came, which is from the earth. Because God had said to Adam, You are dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. That's really what he meant. There was a literal meaning and a metaphorical meaning. Literally, I came naked from my mother's womb. Metaphorically, I shall return there. He's talking now of Mother Earth. And in all this, he did not reproach God. He just blessed God. He bowed to the will of God. He submitted. He honored God. He proved his integrity. He vindicated God's claim that he was one that feared God, that he was a perfect and upright man. But Satan wasn't through. In chapter 2, we read about Satan's further attempt. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, Where have you come from? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. He was still perpetuating his lie. It's all mine. Everybody's under my dominion. That's the kind of thing he said to the Lord when he put him on a high mountain. He showed him all the kingdoms of earth in a moment of time, and he said, all this belongs to me, and the glory of these kingdoms. It is all given to me. But the Lord, in verse 3, said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. In that statement that God makes here to Satan, God is taking direct and full responsibility. It's Satan who has brought ruin upon Job, but God says, I am responsible. And what we have here is a very important point in theology. There aren't two powers vying for control in our universe. There is only one supreme power, and that is God himself. And if Satan does anything, it is only by God's leave that he does it. So we must avoid this unconscious trap of dualism, so-called, where we think about two powers, two rival powers, each bidding for supremacy. Maybe, I know this is from the sublime to the ridiculous, but maybe you watch Star Trek. And in one of them, there was the time traveler. There were two of them. One was good and one was evil. And they were eternally locked, grappling with each other, and no escape for them. Well, many of these episodes in Star Trek were meant to deal with philosophical problems. And that was certainly one of them. Why is there always a conflict between good and evil? Will it ever end? In this case, God shows us very plainly in his word, he is supreme. And nothing can happen without his permission. Or by his decree. The will of God can be either by decree or by permission. There are certain things God says, it shall be so. And there are others where God says, I will allow it to be so. In this case, God says, you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Although Satan was the instrument, God is the effective cause. That raises terrific problems. But that's what the Word of God states. And the other side also has problems to it. Well, here's Satan's answer. And Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth thy hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, he will curse thee to thy face. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your power, only spare his life. When he said skin for skin, it's an enigmatic thing. It's the kind of thing, what does he mean, skin for skin? I suppose the closest is by saying a man will risk his skin to save his skin. That's the closest you can get to that saying there. He's prepared to give anything in order to save his life, even risk his own skin to save his skin. So the Lord said, he's in your power. Satan said, if you touch him, he's sure to curse you to your face. Yes, I know he hasn't cursed you yet, but that's because he's just glad to get away with his life. He's glad that at least he is still well and whole. So the Lord said, all right, try him. Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils. Those sore boils, very hard to know what they were. It could have been the pox, smallpox, chicken pox. Could have been shingles, could have been a number of things, but Certainly they were sore. They were very ugly to look at. They were suppurating. Because we read about Job, verse 8, he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. He sat among the ashes because he was in mourning. It was the custom to sprinkle ashes on oneself when one was in mourning. But also the disease was so revolting he couldn't stay in the house. He was, oozing pus. So he sat outside on the ash. One of the interesting things that an old commentator pointed out is that Satan didn't smite Job's tongue. He wanted Job to curse God. So he spared Job's tongue in hopes that Job would use it to curse God. It didn't work. Another interesting thing we find is that Job's wife was left alone in this. Nothing happened to her. She didn't get sore boils or anything, although she shared with him in his bereavement and in his anguish at his loss. But now his wife herself gave way under the pressure. Verse 9, then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." The Hebrew says, "Bless God and die." And people have wondered, why would she say that? Bless God and die. And I think she's being sarcastic here. Here you are, she says, the more you bless God, the more you vindicate him, the worse your misery is. So go on blessing him and finally you'll die. Don't give over. Just keep on and for sure you'll end your life. She was bitter. Verse 10, but he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He didn't say, "You are a foolish woman," but "You're talking like one." You can see here his concern for his wife. Even she can't make him give way. And he won't even turn back and snap at her in his anguish and in his pain. He remonstrates with her. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He was willing to accept that everything came from God, good and bad. There was worse to come. There's not only the loss of his goods, the loss of his health, and his own wife turning on him, but now his three friends come along. Ostensibly, they came to comfort him, but in effect, all they did was to make his misery worse. You've heard that expression, Job's comforters. It refers to people who come along just when we are in deep pain, and they only make the pain worse. An acquaintance of mine lost a nephew in a tragic accident in the Okanagan. He was driving home from a wedding. He was on the right side of the road, going downhill, just outside Summerland. Two lanes. There were two lanes on the other half of the road, going up. There's one young fellow in a four-wheel drive that had been drinking. He crossed those two lanes and ran head into this car, which this young man was driving. And he was killed outright. At the funeral service, someone came up to the mother and said, "It's all right, it's the will of God." That's the worst thing you can say to someone who's just lost a loved one. You don't talk like that. The best thing is silence or tears. Well, these people came along and they did even worse than that. They said, "Job, you're hiding something. This should never have happened to you. You've got to have done something wrong." They started well anyway, but that was at the end of chapter 2 is the end of their wisdom. Let's read about them in verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. Someone called them eager Eliphaz, bilious Bildad, and zealous Zophar. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Today in Jewish custom, the first 7 days are called heavy mourning, Shiva in Hebrew. When there's a death in the family, for the first 7 days, the relatives will mourn with all their energy, with all their heart. They cry it out. They give vent to their grief. It's very good, really. It's a kind of a safety valve. Well, these people sat down with him on the ground for 7 days and 7 nights with no one speaking a word to him. That's one of the best ways in which you can show sympathy for someone. Just sit where they are. Just share their grief. And then be very careful what you say. A father who lost his little child said, "It wasn't what people said that helped. It was what they did." He said, "When we were coming home from the funeral, we remembered that our kids had to do their newspaper rounds. But when we got to our house, we found that our friends had taken the newspapers round themselves." That's the kind of thing that really counts. Well, these people did right. They sat down with Job, but then in chapter 3, we find that Job at last had to say something or he would have burst. Chapter 3. Afterward, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He didn't curse God, but he did curse the day he was born. He was not the only one either. Jeremiah did the same. Let's look at Jeremiah chapter 20, and we'll see a similarity between that man of God and Job, which shows us really that men of God are only human, men and women of God, and that we can't be too hard on them when they're under extreme pressure. That's not the time to judge them or evaluate them. Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 14. "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let the day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, 'A baby boy has been born to you,' and made him very happy. But let that man be like the cities which the Lord overthrew without relenting. And let him hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave and her womb ever pregnant. Why did I ever come forth from the womb to look on trouble and sorrow, so that my days have been spent in shame?" There's Jeremiah. And Job here speaks in a similar way. We're back in Job chapter 3. "And Job said, 'Let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived.'" He was trying to give vent to his sad thoughts. "May the day perish, let it be wholly forgotten. May that day be darkness, let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it." So much for the day. But now he comes to the night. "As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months." He is just saying, may it never be known as a night of joy, as an anniversary of anything good. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. There's another interesting statement, and people scratch their heads. What does it mean? Let those curse it who curse the day who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. It probably refers to Leviathan. Here is a great sea monster. It refers to those who are hunting this fearful sea monster. The only time in which they can really creep up on it and get it is at night. And they've got everybody organized. They've just closed in on this unsuspecting and perhaps slumbering sea monster. And suddenly the first streaks of dawn light up the eastern sky, and they curse the day because they are thwarted at the last minute from their hopes. That's probably what he's referring to, because Leviathan later on in this book is described as a great sea monster. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light but have none. Neither let it see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb or hide trouble from my eyes. Having cursed the day and the night, he then asks, why was I ever born? Verse 11, why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me? And why the breasts that I should suck? For now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest. And he mentions those with whom he would have rested, with kings and with counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver, or like a miscarriage, which is discarded, I would not be, as infants that never saw light. Incidentally, he regards the miscarriage as a person here. He ascribes personality, humanity, not like our legislators today who regard them as just things to throw away. There the wicked cease from raging, and there the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. It's a very poetic description of what the grave is like. Then he goes on to complain the fact that, well, I have been born, but look at the result of it. Why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul? Well, if I didn't die at birth, he says, why can't I die now? He's tired of living. I who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice greatly, they exult when they find the grave. Now I really want to die, and somehow I can't die. There's no mention here of suicide. He's not contemplating suicide. You see, he is a perfect and an upright man, and he knows very well that it is for God to give, it's for God to take away, and that he cannot lay violent hands on himself. That he is indirectly complaining that God has not ended his life. Why am I living? What's the purpose of it all? What have I to look forward to? Verse 23. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, and whom God has hedged in? For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. Of course, when someone is under great stress, they're not possessed of a healthy appetite. You have an example of that in Ecclesiastes 12. Little statement he makes there about people who are in great grief. In Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 5, he speaks about the time of grief, the time of mourning. And he says, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the streets. Almonds are delicacies. Here's the almond tree blossoming, but no delicacy for him. The grasshopper drags himself along. Literally, the grasshopper is a burden. Well, we do know that roasted grasshoppers were a delicacy in the ancient Near East. You get these stone frescoes or these stone reliefs of the Assyrian kings, and in one picture of their banquet, you see locusts on a skewer, roasted locusts, being brought into the banquet. They were obviously delicacies, but nobody wants to eat them at this time because the caperberry is ineffective. There's another kind of a fruit, capri in Hebrew. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. No appetite, he says. My groaning comes at the sight of my food. Take it away. I don't want it. Eat something. No, I don't have an appetite. And then he says, for what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. And in saying that, he's putting the finger on at least some of his motivation for all his devotion to God. It's not the whole thing, it's not the whole picture, but obviously there was a fear that if he didn't watch his step, a ton of bricks would drop on his head. He says, for what I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, and I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. I tried the thing which I feared. Literally in Hebrew, I feared a fear, and it came upon me. So there was still that lurking fear. If I don't watch my step, then God is going to come down on me. He's going to be very hard on me. He said, so I tried everything to make sure to try and prevent this thing from happening, and it still happened. I knew it, he says. I knew it. Still trouble comes. But still trouble came. Well, you can see already from this third chapter, these last two verses, that although Job was a perfect and an upright man, one that feared God and was always departing from evil, there was still that lurking fear of God that should not be there in a child of God. We'll take a break now, but when we come back, we'll see how his friends just rub salt into the wound. But as we go along, we'll find they're only really verbalizing what he's been hiding in his heart. So they aren't really so bad after all for him. They seem to be terrible and pitiless and merciless, but really what they're doing is dredging up his innermost thoughts and forcing him to face them and answer them. So in the end, God uses them to do Job a favor. And through them, we find in this book, Job answers all his fears, all his misgivings. He faces them and he lays them to rest. And after that, at the end of this book, we'll find he is able to resume his relationship to God, but one now that has not got that nagging fear in it anymore. That's the wonderful thing of how wonderful thing we find in this book, that God is able to make evil, turn evil into good. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Well, we'll see that unfold, but let's take a break for a quarter of an hour.